Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 109, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
Oh, we've got some husky voices in the studio tonight.
Have you guys managed to get any rest since play?
We were at Play Expo in Blackpool over the weekend, and I think it's fair to say Blackpool is the party capital of the UK.
Definitely. We were all a bit worse for wear on Sunday afternoon or Sunday morning.
Other than Ravi. All day Sunday.
All day Sunday. Sleeping in the car on the way home. Yeah.
Not me. I was driving.
Not Dan, but I was.
Maybe a micro nap every now and then. But obviously we were in Play Blackpool over the weekend. And I think I'd say this is the biggest Play event we've done in Blackpool. It's our third year now, and the attendance there was just through the roof.
I was blown away by the amount of people. You know, we were doing these talks, and there was just standing room at the back, and it was just so popular. It was really good. And the whole event was popular, actually. The Sunday was like as busy as a Saturday.
I'd agree. I was worried it wasn't going to be that busy. I was like, oh, playing in February, it's not been that long since the last one.
Yeah.
But prove me wrong, it was busy as ever. And in the Sunday, I think Dan, you said it was the busiest it'd ever been on a Sunday.
Busiest Sunday they've ever had, I believe, just even apart from the Samoans and everything, it was the busiest one ever. And obviously, we were down there all weekend, hosted, what, 5 talks, didn't we?
Oh, yeah.
A few that we've had on the show before, so we're not going to kind of repeat old ground, but we've got one today that I think is actually a UK first. We had 4 of the biggest YouTubers, all together, 4 the UK's first retro gaming YouTuber panel.
You know, I rewatched it and it's just absolutely incredible. Really good panel. I think it's some of the best work we've done.
There was a lot of buzz around it. On the Saturday night, you know, we saw quite a few listeners, went out, you know, quite a few drinks and stuff like that. And they had a lock-in, which was awesome. And a lot of the people at the lock-in were really hyped about the YouTube panel, were saying like, you know, this YouTube panel is going to be amazing. And, you know, it was, so.
Yeah, it was. Like you said, standing room only. So we had Kim Justice, Ashens, Stuart
Slopes
Ashen was there. Slope Game Room, Danny Libertson, Nostalgia Nerd, Peter Lee. Obviously, we've had all these on the show separately, but this interview is actually really interesting because we'll get quite a bit of debate going on. And
yeah, there's a lot of back and forth, and, you know, they don't always agree on the same point, so you kind of get all different angles of debate, you know, it's great.
Yeah, and there's a few audience questions and stuff that were really good too. So we're going to bring you a live recording from Play Expo in Blackpool of our massive YouTuber panel that's coming up on the Retro Hour podcast in around 20 minutes from now. You did mention that we had a bit of a lock-in as well. How amazing was that?
It was amazing. You know what, Ravi? So the story goes, Ravi in the morning is going on about this lock-in we're going to have in the evening.
Yeah.
Well, like, what's Ravi on about lock-in? He's like, it's going to be smoke machines. It's going to be a laser show. It's going to be a rave. And he was like, they're going to lock it down. It closes at 6 and it reopens at 7 till about 1, 2 in the morning.
After party.
After party for all the staff, VIPs, guests, you know, anybody who kind of worked it.
It was like, it was kind of because everyone was working in the daytime. Yeah. And they didn't get to play on anything.
Exactly. So, and I was calling bull on Ravi. I was like, nah, it's not, you know. And then the organiser, I forget his name.
Andy.
A good old Andy. He mentioned it in the green room. And I thought, oh, okay, all right, it is happening.
Oh, it might be official.
It might be official, but it's Ravi, you know.
There's not going to be a raving.
Yeah, there's not going to be a laser show. But, you know, we get to go in. And we walk in on the dot, 7 o'clock. And heaven behold, there's a smoke machine, laser show, there's a rave. And it was brilliant, wasn't it?
Don't doubt the lad.
And you know, the best thing is, as well, we had so many nice people come up to us. You know, we had Peter Edwards, he'd come from South Africa. He's in London.
Just for play.
And he thought he'd pop up and see us. And, you know, we could sneak them all in.
So it was great. Loads of people.
Well, this is the funny thing. So that hour from 6 to 7, Ravi goes like, how are we going to sneak people in? How are we going to break in? And I'm like, Ravi, we've all got VIP wristbands.
He wanted to go on the fire escape, didn't he? Just to be a rebel. But, I mean, to me, obviously, all the arcades there were old school arcades anyway.
Yeah.
And like you said, we didn't get a chance to play them in the day because
we run off our feet. So, you know.
Yeah, we never normally do. But because we had this lock-in afterwards and the DJ was all playing, it was all 90s music.
Oh, yeah. It was so cheesy, but it worked so well. When we were playing the games on the arcades, it was like they were going with the music.
Yeah.
It was great.
I was listening to Live and Joy, Don't Stop Moving while playing Outrun. I thought, this is, he couldn't get more old school than this.
Me and Ravi joined a Halo tournament and what was it? It was all like, you know, push it to the limit, like 80s kind of stuff. It was like
cartouche and all that stuff.
It was so good.
Yeah, and the smoke machine was blasting. And then I think there was me and Steve Hammond from DMA Design at the bar for about 4 hours. Yeah. Every time my pint ran low, he put another one in my hand. Yeah. So
that's the thing, Blackpool, cheap pints.
Yeah, agreed.
They'll explain the head on there, Sunday morning, and maybe the slightly blurry bit at the end of the
night. Yeah, and then we had to do the massive YouTubers panel. So
I think we pulled it off, though.
We did. I mean, you guys did.
Blackpool, definitely. It's always a party weekend. And I got a few pickups. Actually, managed to get some Atari Jaguar games.
Yeah, no, you did. We arrived. We got there nice and early Saturday morning because you wanted like that hour or two just to kind of, not put your feet up, but just kind of have a quick look around. Yeah. Ravi had been there from the night before. Well, so we turned up.
He's
and
on
Ravi's,
a two-day bender.
Yeah, he's a two-day bender. He turned up and he knew where everything
was. Margate.
And me and Dan, we went homed in on the Jag games. There's one store with Jag games. You just homed in on them, didn't you?
Well, normally, it's this Console Passion that had them. And I always go up to them and go, have you got any Jaguar games? Oh, no, we don't get many of them. Walk there, and I was like, Jaguar games!
They had about 15, and you had all of them but about three or four, didn't you?
Yeah, so I picked them. But actually, they weren't bad prices either. About £20 each I paid for them.
Yeah, pretty good.
And I'd love to thank the people that also bought us things as well.
Yeah, what did you get?
I got a Tapuino thing, which is basically a little tape loader for the Commodore 64.
The fast loader thing.
Yeah, from Peter Edwards. And Miss Mad Lemon also bought me a fast loader for the C64.
We got an SD card reader thing.
Yeah, and a little Buggy Boy game. But also, we got a really cool from George Tui. He made us a custom little, was it?
It's like a retro hour LED panel, isn't it?
So, so cool. It's kind of got LEDs on the bottom and it's etched in, I think it's Perspex or glass, and it all highlights the retro hour logo, which was just mind-blowing.
We'll stick a picture of it on Facebook because there was a stall selling them there as well, and he said, oh, this is a guy that did it for you. But that's the thing, it blows me away every year because we've done this show for 2 years now, but apart from like tweets and Facebook messages, it's like three guys sat in a badly decorated room on a Tuesday night. You know, I mean, you don't realise just how many people listen and get involved. And you can't beat meeting people face to face and shaking their hands. I mean, far too many people to mention, but we appreciate everyone who came up and said they listened to the show.
I just loved when we were walking along in that hour gap and I just heard a load of people go, that's Amiga guy. It's Amiga Dan. And I was like, what's going on here? And we turn around, a group of lads straight away.
Yeah.
And I was just like, that's brilliant.
They were top blokes, weren't they?
Yeah, they
and obviously everyone recognises Handsome Joe.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Autographs all weekend long.
They were just blinded by the handsomeness.
Put me on the spot in the pub, actually, on the Saturday night. I was like, for God's sake.
I made him introduce himself to everyone as Handsome Joe. Like, this guy's full of himself. But yeah, what another amazing weekend. And obviously there are more events coming up. You're in Margate this weekend for Geek. And then obviously we'll have play. I think we're going to be in Glasgow and Manchester later in the year too, so we'll keep the calendar up to date on our website.
The fun doesn't stop.
Never stops. Now, speaking of our website, theretrohour.com, that is a place where you can head to if you'd like to show your support for the show. I mean, it's amazing when we go out and meet people face to face. If you can't make it to an event and you just want to say thanks for us doing the show each week, anything we get into our tip jar is massively appreciated and obviously allows us to keep doing the show week in, week out without having to pay for the entire thing out of our own pocket, which is always nice.
Yep.
So thank you if you've made a donation this week. You'll make your place in the Hall of Fame if you do, just like Paul Vince,
Graham Stevenson,
Greg Girk,
and Lee Langley, who all made donations into the running of the Retro Hour podcast this week. Thank you so much, guys. You can do the same. We've got PayPal links, cryptocurrency, any way you want to pay. You'll find it all on the front page of theretrohour.com. Now, before we get into our big YouTubers panel recorded at Play Expo in Blackpool, there are a few news stories to talk about. Now, actually, one thing that we did cover in this panel quite a bit is gaming TV.
Yeah, because, you know, YouTube, it's kind of like the new gaming TV, isn't it? So we were talking about traditional TV and about traditional game show formats. And you remember Go 8-Bit last year.
Yeah, I think there's a new series of that just started, isn't it?
It started last night.
Yeah, I thought it.
Monday night.
and that show is, I mean, it's all right just to see old games on screen, but it's hardly Games Master.
I was games really World. Not a fan of it because when I saw it, it had that kind of taking the mick out of gamers vibe when they were doing a lot of jokes. Mm. And as a gamer, it's really annoying to see that. It's like, why does that have to be in there? Yeah. You know, you could just be friendly and open. But
that old stereotype that gamers are all nerds who live in the mum's basement.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of thing.
And that's always backed up on every episode.
Some of them are quite handsome, to be fair.
Yeah. can't think of any of those.
He's getting to his head.
He's going to get a T-shirt printed with it on next,
I will
next year we go.
Just my face on it.
Selling his own merch store, yeah.
Yeah.
So there is a new gaming television show then.
Yes, and this is a by Rob Beckett. And people probably don't know who Rob Beckett is, but he's a comedian, stand-up guy with massive teeth. That's how you probably remember.
As soon as you said that, I was like, I know the guy. Blonde hair, quite short, isn't yeah. he? He's actually quite funny. He's often on, like, Have I Got News For You and shows like that, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah, he's quite good. And this is going to be called Playing For Time, and it's going to be on Channel 4.
Now, unfortunately, it does kind of sound like the format is quite similar to Go 8-Bit.
Really does, doesn't it?
It's got, like, Josh Widdicombe on there, Rachel Riley, Scarlett Moffat. It's kind of like the same kind of panellists you get on all comedy like shows.
I'm not sure, because it says it's a four-part series.
Okay.
And he's going to look through kind of like, you know, the games kind of through the decades.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's more going to be kind of like a review format. I'm not sure.
Or yeah, you know, like a historic look rather than a quiz.
Yeah.
But it might be just like, do you remember Street Fighter?
Yeah.
You know?
But off the back of what Ravi was saying a minute ago, with him being a comedian, is it going to be him taking the mic?
Yeah.
In each episode, out of it, like, well, look at that.
I don't know how much of a gamer he is. Obviously, we had that, you know, the Ian Lee Thumb Candy documentary back in the early 90s. And he was a comedian who did a really good job on it. But it's a fact that, the kind of red light for me is the fact that it's got Josh Widdicombe and all them you see on, like, 9 out of 10 cats and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
They're probably, you know, thinking about it, they might just be talking heads who come on and, you know, between the bits, maybe.
Yeah, they might have like a little history sections and stuff. But Dara O'Brien as well, he seemed to be a bit of a gamer as well. Yeah. So, but then it's with TV, it's always what the producers decide, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, they could have a concept and it could get totally changed. And we've got to aim for the young teenagers or something, you know.
Well, it does sound like it's going to be a nostalgic show, because apparently it's going to stop off in the 80s and 90s and the noughties, where they're going to dress in fashions of the era, and there'll be music from the era, from New Romantics to grunge, while sharing stories reminiscent about movies, music crazes each decade, and obviously video games as well.
It sounds potentially awful, I'm afraid to say.
But I mean,
one way or the other.
Even just seeing classic games on TV, I've got a feeling it's going to just be, like you said, Street Fighter and Pac-Man,
yeah,
isn't
yeah.
it? You know,
yeah.
I doubt you're going to see anything.
What's the new series like, Joe? Have you seen much of Go 8-Bit, the new series?
Oh, no, I've never watched. I wrote it off straight away.
Yeah.
Same
here. After three episodes or something.
I was like, Go 8-Bit. So I clicked on it and they're playing Street Fighter. Well, that's not 8-Bit, and turned it off.
Yeah. The last time I watched it, they were playing Flappy Bird or something. Yeah,
they did that zany change positions thing where the thing goes around and they go, ooh, on the seats. Oh, God.
It takes about 2 minutes for the set to spin around, doesn't it?
I watch a lot of TV.
But that's the thing. It's like you said, YouTube's the new gaming TV. But
absolutely.
I think they've got to make these kind of TV shows, if they do any about video gaming, really for people that are not that into games, I guess.
Yeah.
So they're the audience that they're aiming for.
But I'd agree with that. Yeah.
It's always good to see some form of gaming covered on TV, I guess, but bring back Games Master.
Yes.
Come on, Dominic, we know you're listening. There's been a lot of activity on the Game Boy scene recently. Tell us about this interesting little gadget you found.
This is called the Pocket Sprite, and it's tiny. Like, this is the size of about a VMU or a box of matches.
So this is a little gaming device that you can hang on your keyring, essentially.
I didn't believe him. So Ravi sends me the link, and he's like, oh, it fits in the palm of your hand. And I was like, oh, once again, it's Ravi. It's going to be a bit smaller.
Like a big CRT or something.
It's going to be a bit smaller than a Game Boy Pocket, or it's just going to be like the Game Boy Micro. So I watched a video, and it's tiny.
Yeah.
It's literally like, I don't know, it's so small.
I've got a fob for my garage gates at home, and it's about the same size.
Yeah, literally. Like, it's just, you know, like you say, it's keyring size, it's key size.
Yeah.
So,
You know, they say it's really tiny, but it's got an OLED screen, you see. And OLED is really expensive to get for the phones and all of this stuff. So I can imagine they've probably made it that small, because getting those screens would be cheaper. And
And it makes it unique as well, though, because, you know, there's no point in making yet another Game Boy clone that's the same size as the original.
Exactly. Yeah.
And obviously people are interested. They've got a Crowd Supply, which is a like a fundraising, crowdfunding website. They've set this on. They wanted $20,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they've currently got 74,591, and there is still 37 days left on it at the moment. So,
wow. so it's clear market for it. But
yeah.
When will the novelty kind of fall off as well with it?
I think what's nice about it is having, even though it's tiny, it's got a little D-pad on it, and it's got physical controls. It's not trying to do it on a touchscreen, so...
It also corrects the aspect ratio for the older games, so they fit the screen. It supports Game Gear, Game Boy Color, Master System.
That's in the Sega games, too.
Oh, yeah, built-in Wi-Fi and Bluetooth as well, 8-bit audio, so...
wonder how many you can fit on. Did they actually say how many games you can... You put your own ROMs on, I guess, yeah?
Yeah, I guess. I assume that it's done through a micro SD.
You makes sense. So, yeah, well, that's... I mean, you never thought you'd have all those systems on your keyring.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the novelty of it is pretty cool.
Yeah.
But I'd be like, yeah, look at this, you know. And then, like, after 2 minutes of playing it, I'd be like, okay, cool, I'm done.
I don't know, because I think if it was, like, a LED screen, like a Tamagotchi or something, it might get boring. But OLED, it so stands out, because that's what they have on the Apple Watch as well. Yeah. And, you know, that's a tiny screen, but it's really defined. So
I think with this, yeah, I mean, actually, the screen probably does look about the same size as an Apple Watch.
Yeah.
And it's got, you know, physical buttons on there and everything. I think it's the kind of thing that, obviously, with it being SD card based, it's going to be instant loading.
Yeah.
So I guess it'd be the kind of thing if you're just maybe waiting for a taxi or you've got 2 minutes to kill, you just quickly get a game on.
Yeah, there is that. Yeah.
So that's probably the market that, you know, they're probably aiming for. You're not going to sit down on the couch and play that for like 4 hours, probably.
No.
I think it's pretty cool, though.
Sat there playing it when you've got everything in front of you.
You've got your 60-inch TV there, yeah. But I think, you know, it's always cool to see something that's kind of a novel concept. And the fact that it's 372% funded is... I think a testament to the fact that it is a pretty decent idea, so we'll keep an eye on that.
Totally.
Now, multi-carts seem to be making a comeback. Now, these are cartridges that have got several games on.
Mm.
Yeah, I think Joe might know about these, because there was all these old random Japanese ones that they used to get, weren't they?
Yeah, well, I mean, they look nice. So we've got this retro bit doing these new multi-carts. We've got four on the go. So we've got the Jaleco Brawlers Pack, Data East Classic Collection, Data East All-Star Collection, and then Joe and Mac Ultimate Cave Collection. So not your typical kind of repros you'll see. Usually you see, you know, like your kind of your Contras and your Zeldas and your super rare, like only Japanese releases. So it's pretty cool to see some different releases, and also one's Nintendo and then three are Super Nintendo. But the quality looks a lot better, but it does. It's straight away, it's that kind of like flashback to, you know, being in the 90s, early 2000s, sitting in Spain and buying one of those 50-in-1 carts for your Game Boy or something.
Or Skegness.
Yeah, Skegness, yeah, Blackpool.
And they've got them for the SNES and the NES as well. So they've got the NES form factor in there.
Yeah.
Well, I'm looking at this NES one here, the Data East All-Star Collection. You've got stuff like Burger Time on there, Bad Dudes, Ring King, Side Pockets. So, yeah, they are like some classic games from these companies.
Yeah, I mean, and it's reasonably priced because of... That's one thing I'm earned about as well, about a lot of these repros. Like, a repro will come out of, like, a game and it's like £50 for one game, and you think, you know what, on eBay I could probably get that game for £50 or £60.
Yeah,
you know, it, obviously it might be a bit battered or something, you get a nice, you know, shiny new one which is repro, but you know, most of these are like $30, $35, so it's pretty reasonable. But once again, could you get those games for that kind of price? I don't know, but it is nice. They do look, the quality of them does look very nice, you know, when it sits there on your shelf.
Yeah, and I think this company, Retrobit, you know, they're doing some great hardware at the moment and add-ons and stuff. So I think there'll be a lot more of these announced, maybe for, you know, Mega Drives and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, it looks like they're testing the water, really, doesn't it, by putting four out. So I guess, you know, like you said, the price is not bad at all. And you get they get an instruction manual in there as well. It's fully boxed. You know, the artwork looks really good in it. And it also comes with an exclusive button and sticker set and things. So I think they're kind of aiming at, like, you know, maybe the collectible kind of market.
Yeah, true.
You know, something new. But yeah, it looks pretty cool, I think.
Do we know if they're kind of like officially licensed or not? I don't know enough really myself.
Yeah, that's a question. You'd imagine with it being, I mean, obviously they're not actual Nintendo games, are they?
Yeah.
So they probably played it a bit safe there. But yeah.
Well, I think Retrobit's the company that actually got licensing to do the Sega accessories CES. So.
Yeah, because looking at the overview here.
Yeah, they're normally quite legit, aren't they?
It does say, yeah, compatible with all original or third party SNES consoles. So it does mention it.
Well, it hasn't got any Sega logos on it, but you know, I'm sure it'll work. Or Nintendo.
If we look back in a week and it's gone, then you know the answer to that.
Yeah, we know that. Yeah. Keep an eye on it.
Those guys shouldn't have mentioned us on their podcast. I'm sure they're legit. So if you want to find out more about those, and maybe
they're a reputable long term company.
Of course, they are. Yeah. They've been around for years. We'll put a link if you want to find out more, then check out the games list in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, talking of scoring really cool stuff, I mentioned those Jag games that I got. You got some Game Gear stuff actually at play, didn't you?
Yeah, I got 10 little Game Gear games, a few random Japanese ones, so just plug them in and see what happens.
Did you get any pickups at the weekend?
I got a few bits. Didn't spend as much as I usually do, but I'm trying to get a complete Resident Evil collection for everything, you know, every console, every release. And I managed to pick Resident Evil 2 up for the N64 in pretty good nick.
It was 24 quid or something, was it?
No, it was more than that.
Okay. What was I thinking? Oh, you got
Panzer Dragoon for 24 quid. Yeah, I was quite pleased with that.
Yeah, well, I think it'll take some topping Ravi's little bargain that he got last year.
Oh, yeah, my £2 honeybee controller.
Oh, yeah.
Now, just to fill you in if you didn't hear that story, last year we went to, it was my stag do, actually, wasn't it?
In Leeds.
Day after, we found like a cash converters kind of place.
Yeah.
And they had like a box of, they said Sega Mega Drive pads and stuff. And in there, if you're not familiar with the Amiga scene, there was a joypad that came out in about 93, 94 that was a lot better than the original.
It was made by Competition Pro,
yeah,
who make a lot of really cool joypads. But this one was an Amiga CD32 replacement, and it was much better.
Yeah, and they normally go for like about, what, how much, about 130 quid?
Around that, yeah.
Essentially, they just look like a Mega Drive controller. Yeah. Exactly the same, but then the buttons, rather than A, B, and C, it's like a square symbol.
And they don't have the appalling D-pad that they have on the Amiga one as well.
They've got the Sega Mega Drive D-pad.
Nice D-pad.
And then they're just like a slightly off grey colour, aren't they?
So you've got the shoulder buttons and stuff on it too.
So at a glance, it's a Mega Drive controller.
Well, the guy in the shop obviously thought it was, but he said it's a cash converters. He wasn't a console expert.
Yeah. Cash for gold.
But then, when he took it, what did he get it for? About £5?
I think it's £2 or
£2. £2. That's quite a bargain, isn't it? You know, 130 quid. But it proves that there is a market for Amiga joypads, and especially CD32.
I think the reason why they're so expensive is because they just, such a short run of the console, you know.
Yeah.
Well, there is, finally, a new CD32 gamepad. This is called the Procon CD32. And what does that look like at a first glance?
A black Super Nintendo controller.
Looks exactly like a SNES controller.
It's the same shell. Yeah. You know, they've got that from somewhere. You can probably get that. It's probably quite standard now.
Now, am I right in thinking that the D-pad for the SNES recently came out of copyright? That's why it was starting to be used on lots of things.
Oh, maybe.
I think you might be right about
that. We covered that
a while ago.
Isn't it normally like, 20 years patents last for, isn't it?
Yeah,
so that makes sense.
It's because Nintendo, when they did the D-pad, when Sega tried to do the D-pad, they had to, they essentially reverse engineered it because of the patent. But like, I think Ravi, I'm 99.9% sure Ravi's right about that one, about the patent running out. And now you're just seeing all these controllers kind of coming out.
That would make sense because there's been quite a flood of them on the market recently for various systems. But I think, looking at this, it doesn't look like it's specific to the Amiga CD32. It's essentially just a black SNES controller with the CD32 logo on there. But obviously it'll have the Amiga, the 9-pin D-sub connector at the end, I guess.
Yeah, and it's got like, you can map buttons on it. You can remap buttons.
Okay.
You can have a turbo fire and reset, and you can save all the presets as well. So there's like little key combos you can do on it to add extra features or remap, because a lot of Amiga games would have up for jump.
Of course,
Yeah.
That's actually really good then, isn't it? Because the older controllers didn't do that.
No.
Yeah, so there's a lot of games where we'd actually like one of the action buttons to be the jump if using a pad. So it made the sticks, weren't they, a lot of them? But then you look at the little circuit board inside here, though, it does say CD32 on the circuit board, so maybe the actual board itself is custom for the CD32. And obviously it'll do all the CD controls and all that, I imagine, too. Mm. So, but I mean, that has obviously, by the price of the old ones, there is a demand for this.
Well, these are €38, fully built, and you can buy it in kit form for £27, or a partial kit where you just get all the triggers and build it out your own stuff.
Just click on buy it now. Yeah, I think they're going to sell quite a lot.
Yeah, that's available on EAB, which is the Amiga English board.
English Amiga board, yeah. Well, I'll put a link to that in this week's show notes as well. All right, guys, well, thank you for checking out episode number 109 of the Retro Hour podcast. We will be out again next Friday, available from all of your favourite download sites, your favourite podcast clients, and obviously, we did get a few nice reviews, actually, on iTunes recently, didn't we?
We had some really nice ones, and actually, on Facebook, we had a review. I didn't know people could review us on Facebook, so guys, please do that.
I turned it on yesterday. You can optionally put reviews on your page.
Yeah, cool.
So, I put yesterday when we got it on the page, I turned it on, we got one straight away. So.
We'll all go review it ourselves.
Yeah. Be nice, Joe. So, if you'd like to leave a review on any platform, obviously it always really helps us get new listeners and gets up the chart and everything and on iTunes and that kind of thing. So, that is always appreciated, your 5-star reviews. Or three, if you're not going to anything above 3 is all right.
-5. 2-star, right. Bring back Joe.
All right, guys, well, thank you for checking out this week's show. We'll see you again next Friday, and now recorded at Play Expo in Blackpool. Oh, this is so good. Featuring Nostalgia Nerd, Ashens, Kim Justice, and Slopes Game Room, a massive YouTuber panel. Enjoy this, and we'll see you next Friday.
Ciao.
See you later.
Now, there will be a chance for you guys to do a bit of a Q&A at the end, but I thought, you know, let's go from you, Kim. Just introduce yourself and maybe tell us a bit about your channel and what we may know you for.
Yeah, sure, okay. My name is Kim Justice. I've been doing YouTube for about 5 years now. I do documentaries about various subjects that interest me, anything from like Spectrum to Mega Drive, Amiga. I do things about industry figures and companies, things like Ocean Software, Peter Molyneux, Robert Maxwell. I just generally try to cover lots of different shades of prat, basically, a lot of the time. Trying to moderate my language. But yes, I just tend to do stuff on... I do stuff on, like, wrestling as well. I kind of, like, do sort of story-ish documentaries, kind of try and build up characters a lot. And, yeah, that's me pretty much, kind of faking a living at it since 2012. It's kind of cool.
Hello, I'm Stuart Ashen from the channel Ashens, which I've been doing for 12 years. That's not a period of time I like to think about. Where I look at low quality items and take the mickey out of them. And when available, I do some retro gaming stuff because I'm mildly obsessed with it. I've written two books on the subject. Terrible Old Games You've Probably Never Heard Of and Attack of the Flickering Skeletons. Because I like short, concise titles.
Hello, I'm Peter Lee. I run the channel Nostalgia Nerd, which I've been doing for, I don't know, 2 years, maybe 3 years now. My early videos were absolutely terrible. My current ones are questionable. Basically, I cover retro gaming, documentaries on old hardware and computing and software, and just generally talk about that. Quite a lot of nonsense. That's what I do.
Hey everybody, I'm Daniel Wibbertson, aka DJ Slope from Slope's Game Room. I'm probably most known for my The Complete History series, where I try and look into the complete history on particular gaming franchises. My most popular one is Streets of Rage, but with me being a massive Sega fanboy, I do try and go a little bit old school as well to my first love, which was the Amstrad CPC 464 before consoles took over my life. And other than that, I do a few other things, a few quirky videos like the Random Histories, where I try and find really obscure history pieces that hopefully no one else has covered or not covered to the level that I would like it to be covered. And most recently, I've been winding up everyone on Kickstarter by doing my Kick Scammer series. And getting some very DMCAs against me and everything else from all those people out there that like to scam people on Kickstarter. So I like to shine a light on those guys.
So we always like to ask a question. What was your earliest kind of memory of computing or gaming experience? And just go ahead.
Yeah, I'll start. My first computing experience was when I was really quite young. It was about 1990. My dad used to work for Amstrad, like with Alan Sugar and all that lot, and ended up getting me Spectrum Plus 2. So not the old dead flesh rubber keys, like the actual one with the proper keyboard and the data loader that was decently made. So that was kind of where I started. I started on that, I don't know, Postman Pat. If anyone knows that, anything's really terrible alternative software game. Stuff like Codemasters, like Dizzy, Chucky Egg. Have you guys? 3D Death Chase, which is one of my favourite games of all time. And yeah, it just kind of ballooned from there, kind of went from there to Mega Drive, Amiga, PS1. That's kind of my era. That was kind of all through growing up. So yeah, it was really bad alternative software games was kind of my first memory.
Well, my sister, who is older than me, tells me that I used to hang off the Pac-Man machines in pubs when I was very young, looking at the screen and trying to work out what was going on. I never did. My first computer was a VIC-20, Commodore VIC-20, given to me by my uncle, which I had for about 6 months, and I found the games difficult. If you've ever played a VIC-20 game, you'll probably know why. Then for Christmas that year, I got a Gray ZX Spectrum Plus 2. Which was the real doorway into sitting in my bedroom and giving myself a hunched back for the rest of my life. I'm trying to think of great games from that period. well, it started off with the games that it came with free, like
oh God,
Punchy and Disco Dan and
Bullseye.
Not good stuff. And then there were things like Renegade, 3D Death Chase, Fantasy World Dizzy. If anybody disagrees, that's one of the greatest games ever. I will fight you. Good. Yes. Have you got a towel and Remnick in between rounds? Where did we go from that? So then I got an Atari ST, had that for a long time till it kind of died, and got an Amiga, and then it all turned into PCs and everything went beige. My first ever proper console, when it was actually, you know, a thing on the market, was a Sega Saturn, of all things, because I always back the winner. So I had that for about 3 months and then had to get a PlayStation as well because I still wanted to play some games. Yeah, that's it, really.
So my first computer was a ZX Spectrum, which I got probably 1985 or 1986. And I think the first game was Jetpack. I think I was probably more enthralled by the loading screen than the game itself, just because of the flashing colours on screen, and I was very young. But the main memory isn't actually a game. It's probably the BBC Micro and the Turtle software, which you used to get with it. So you used to get a program called Logo, which you could program a turtle on the floor and draw a massive like picture in the middle of a sports hall in the infant school. And I was like, what the hell is this? Blew my mind when I was like 4 years old. And that's just stuck with me ever since, really.
So I was a huge mummy's boy as a kid. So whatever my mum got, that was the computer or the console that I got into. And no matter what my friends had, whether it be a Master System showing me Alex Kidd or, you know, all of these other home consoles, nothing compared to the first game I ever had, which was Bridget for the Amstrad CPC, which isn't a good game in the slightest. But
oh, my God. Are you all right? Do you need therapy?
I was strangely obsessed with it.
Oh, man, it's so bad, isn't it?
It's so bad. And it's impossible to complete because there's no way you'd ever be able to push all the buttons at the same time. Yeah, you can't do well in it. But I was a huge mummy's boy, and no, Alex Kidd, that's crap compared to Bridget. I'd done what I told basically until the day she bought me a Mega Drive. But yeah, originally it was the Amstrad CPC, and I was just obsessed with anything that looked like it could be a mascot that could rival those Mario characters and stuff that I see. So I was obsessed with the Gremlin characters, Thing on a Spring, Bounder, Dizzy. Literally took over my life. I drew pictures of Dizzy all over my wall, and then one Christmas put Christmas hats on every single one of them.
Luckily it was easy to draw.
Yeah, pretty easy, yeah. So yeah, from there I went over to the obviously the Mega Drive, and then by Dizzy it was all about Sonic until I got Fantastic Dizzy for the Mega Drive. From there I just carried on being Sega until, you know, around the PlayStation era, and that was it, really. Now I try and get them all.
Was it mainly gaming that you guys were into then? Because I know, Stuart, people may not know this, you've actually got a couple of public domain releases on the Amiga.
Thanks for bringing that up.
What were they?
My God, so there were three technically. Ooh, no, I lie. Technically two. The first was something called Apathy, which was just a weird front end for the Amiga AMOS programming language speech synthesizer, mainly to amuse my friend Raymond. So that was exactly what the world needed at that time, an in-joke released to public domain libraries. Then there was Gribble, the Revengeo program, where there was just like a little man in a green jumper and you could kill him in different ways by selecting it from a menu. And there were some quite interesting sampled sound effects I nicked off Monty Python. It wasn't a good program. And the only game I actually wrote was never released. Excuse me, called Killjoy, where you little rotoscoped versions of myself, looking a bit like something out of Virtua Cop, but 2D, and quite visually impressive for the Amiga at the time. Well, animation-wise, not if you'd see a still shot of it. And you just shot them, and they fell over. And I finished it the day before the Dunblane massacre. So that was never released, yeah, for obvious reasons. But it was crap anyway, so fair enough.
Well, let's talk about gaming television, because obviously that was huge in the early 90s. And I know Peter and Kim, you often cover it on your channels. What was your favourite gaming television show, Kim? What memories have you got?
My favourite, like the TV shows, was definitely Games Master. Just had to be, you know, all
Boo.
These sort of...
The war's on.
Oh, my God. Just all the Neil and Knuckle humour. I mean, they kind of came off as kind of dicks a lot of the time, as we said, like Dominic Diamond and Dave Perry, like always just clearly hating each other. But I mean, you had Patrick Moore as the games master, even though he knew absolutely nothing about the games, and it was kind of clear of that he still was like kind of a good sport about it. And yeah, it's just a really interesting history. But other than Games Master, one of my favourite shows, which not technically TV, but was kind of on the early days of video on the internet, was Consolvania, which is still going today. Rab and Ryan from Glasgow, Scotland. Yeah, just kind of doing this stuff. And that was a big influence on like the way that I do my gaming reviews these days, because they really kind of got into detail about the game, like actually why it was good, which is kind of what I wanted to do with my channel, instead of saying that everything's crap all the time.
Well, no, Peter, you actually do commentary over old episodes of Bad Influence.
Bad Influence! Yeah.
Tell us about Bad Influence, then. What do you remember about that?
Bad Influence is possibly the greatest programme of all time, I would say. Aside from the fact that Andy Crane, who presented it, knew nothing about computers or games consoles, it was actually... it used to be on at 4:45 on ITV on a Thursday, and after school, it was just the best thing to watch. It was just like... Back then, obviously, we didn't have the internet, so... you'd have to get your reviews from magazines, which were a month out of date, at the least. So Bad Influence provided reviews on, like, the latest games and machines, and just it was everything I needed in a program and more. It still is today. I mean, like, 25 years later, I still watch it, and I think, my God, that's amazing. Look at that. Look at that 8-bit machine. And, you know, forgetting we've advanced to where we are now. It's crazy.
Yeah, I can't really add much to that. That's the one I watched the most as well. Also, the Sky shows after school with Big Boy Barry. Was it Game Zone?
Games World.
Games World, sorry. Yeah, so I used to watch that as well. So, yeah, Bad Influence primarily.
Yeah, it was mostly Games Master for me, I think, because I was a bit older, but still watched Bad Influence as well, because it was just a novelty to see people actually talking about video games as if it was a thing and not something you should hide in a room and be shot if you accidentally played one, you know. First actual, you know, mainstream media realising it existed, I suppose. Now, remind me, Peter, did Bad Influence have like a data blast thing at the end where you had to record it?
It did, yeah, yeah. If you were lucky enough to own a video recorder which didn't create a freeze frame like this, then you could catch some information at the end.
Well, you've confirmed my memory. We didn't have one of those VHS players, and I would record it and then try and read it and couldn't. And that still annoys me to this day.
Yeah.
And you can't forget about Nam Wood as well.
Oh, Nandru. What's his name? Andy? Oh.
Andy Weir.
Andy Weir, yes.
Nam Wood's Doorman Backwards.
Yeah. Which blew my mind.
Yes, it still does me today.
He lives in Australia now, doesn't he?
Is he?
Yeah. That's a completely pointless fact for you.
Last time I saw him, he was in Emmerdale, wasn't he?
Yes, and in Mr. Biffo's fan footage.
Was he?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Must have missed that.
Yeah. Well, that's one for you to go and look at afterwards. Why don't we all do the same? That's a plug.
So, do you guys think that gaming TV needs to be back on TV? Would there be a kind of demand for gaming?
Definitely needs to come back. I think there's such a... So it's an audience for it now. If you brought back Games Master, and you know, we've got Go 8-Bit, haven't we, on Dave by Dara Breen, which is okay, but it's not quite the same as Games Master. Hasn't quite got the same cool edge. If you brought back Games Master with Dominic Diamond, probably wouldn't do it, but someone else and had that
with the competitions and
the competitions. Yeah, I think it would be amazing. You could do like a retro section. You could do the new systems. I think the audience is even bigger now for it. It boggles my mind why they don't do it. To be honest,
I don't think they need it. You've got YouTube now. It's like YouTube is so niche for each channel. You can, you know, go and find out a channel dedicated to Amstrad, or you can go find, you can find exactly what you want.
Yeah, but like if a program about knitting on terrestrial TV will get more views than most YouTube programs, won't it? So, I mean, if you put a gaming show out there.
Well, I'm going to have to go with Daniel on this one, because TV audience is really shrinking. And
I hate you all.
People who are playing games, not generally watching that much television. Occasionally I'll talk to the BBC when they have they want to speak to a YouTuber, because I'm the only one over the age of 3. And so I go in and they're so sort of entrenched in the old linear programming stuff, they don't realise like the average age of a television viewer is now over 50. I mean, the kids are not watching it. And we always give the Peppa Pig example. Like, right, a kid wants to watch Peppa Pig. They'll get their tablet their dad got from Maplin for 50 quid. I mean, it's a bit shonky, but it plays Peppa Pig. They get it up, play Peppa Pig, tea's ready. Okay, pause that, off we go. Try explaining to them that, right, you can only watch Peppa Pig at 4:30 p.m. on a Thursday, and if you miss it, that's the end of it. And if they come and you've forgot to watch your tea, then you can't record it, you can't ever see it again. What? You know, there's just no need for that anymore for the newer generations. And plus, with the turnaround time of TV shows, you'd be so behind it. What I think could work is a television show around games. So it'd be like features and maybe retro stuff and, yeah, you know, something that isn't trying to provide news because it would always be behind it. Maybe there'd be something for that. But if anybody's ever dealt with a television company in video games, you will know they hate them. They always see it as a competitor to television.
Well, it is, isn't it?
But they didn't with films.
Mm. It is, but I mean, but it's always been historically, it's always just been a great rivalry between, because essentially a gaming TV program is advertising something that's going to take away people from watching television. So it's
precisely
kind of polar opposites in a way. So it's, I don't think, I mean, as much as, you know, it'd be nice to see gaming TV back, because, you know, there is a certain professionalism about a TV program, some of them anyway. And that, you know, you've got a crew and, you know, you've got proper plush reviews and big sets and all that, like Games Master back in the day on the oil rig and all that. But will it happen? I don't see it. I just don't see, like...
You'll get plenty of attempts. You'll get plenty of attempts and they just won't do it as well as, you know, what we want to see on telly, you know. Look at this retro game, Pac-Man and Space Invaders, and it will never really go to the anywhere above the real obvious... I don't think mass market stuff.
One of the problems is, if you look at it over the years, there have been so few attempts at gaming shows, considering how gaming has grown. Yeah. I mean, Games Master was like the biggest program on Channel 4 at the time,
wasn't it? It was, yeah.
And yet, oh no, people won't watch television programs about games. No, it's because exactly as Kim says, it was seen as a rival.
And the only reason why it had like the budget it had was Games Master actually, you don't know, it kind of ended up in like the sport part of Channel 4, which is why there were so many sportsman guests. Like, they always had people like Vinnie Jones and Jimmy White and various other sportsmen, just because it ends up in the sports programme so that they'd get a bigger budget. Kind of like how Young Ones for the BBC was in music.
So that's why they always had bands.
Yep, that is why.
Well, talking of television that we watched as kids, Stuart, you actually brought back a classic show a couple of years ago on YouTube. Tell us about the remake of Nightmare.
Well, you can't thank me for it directly because I didn't pay for it. I really didn't pay for it. I cannot stress that enough. Yeah, that was an odd one. It was old YouTube wanted to do something for Geek Week and somebody, which was like a week of geeky stuff they did. Really glad I explained that in case you couldn't work out what Geek Week was. Somebody came up with the idea of bringing back Nightmare, and all the original team, Tim Child, etc., were all on board for it, and we literally filmed it in Norwich in the old studio, which is now like an independent place, in front of a blue screen, not a green screen, you know, really old stuff. I got to put the bucket on my head. You walk into walls a lot wearing that bucket. They don't edit that in, but every 5 seconds it's...
See, you watch it as a kid, you thought it was probably filmed in like a field or something, but...
Yeah, no, it's just a tiny little blue area.
They put you like in a cupboard.
And poked me with a stick and said, I'm a goblin. The more I think about it, that's not that far from the truth, actually.
But obviously, you got to meet like Traegard. I'd have been starstruck meeting him.
Oh, he lives locally. Old Hugo Myers. What a lovely bloke. And I was quite worried when I first saw him because he'd gone so grey and old. Then I realised, no, that's makeup. They'd literally done him up to look older and not warned us beforehand. And then he came back from having it removed. Like, bloody hell, you know. He's gone back in time 20 years.
He looks almost exactly the same, doesn't he?
He absolutely does, yeah.
Wow.
That was an interesting one from a YouTube perspective as well, because YouTube never gets particularly interested in anything from a sort of admin point of view. But as soon as they heard they were bringing back a TV show, oh, they were so excited. So never believe it when YouTube say they're the future. They are obsessed with becoming television.
You're backing up my idea about a TV game show. You said YouTube's good, and now bring TV back.
No, I'm not saying. I'm saying that's what YouTube want to become, television, and take over the audience.
Oh, yeah, I mean, they're desperate for legitimacy, which is why you've got the whole YouTube red thing, and they always try to make big stars out of the biggest YouTubers. Unfortunately, what then ends up happening is they end up going to Japan and just filming some dead bodies. Mm. And
that is natural progression.
And... So it's like, back to the drawing board. Who's next? I mean, they'll get to me eventually, I'm sure, but... I'm always open.
Well, about your YouTube videos, you and Slopes have amazingly researched videos, and I'd like to know how you go through your process of research and kind of make sure your information is all accurate.
There's no one answer. I mean, I've got a Google Drive folder full of maybe 50 scripts that I still haven't finished. Some may never see the light of day. And one of those scripts isn't a script. It's just an idea page of pages and pages and pages of articles that I've read, and maybe an article out of a retro gamer magazine or an actual a gaming magazine from back in the day. And every so often, for instance, now I don't have this weekend's video ready yet. And I sort of make it up as I go along. Okay, now this is really interesting. Now I'm going to research this guy. What else has he done? And then I'll research. Okay, can I find anything else out about? So the next one will probably be Road Rash, The Complete History, and I'll have to go and find some information out about that or some information. I don't know how I do it. If I'm honest, I just make it up as I go along. And if an article falls in my lap, that's really cool. So that's it.
So yeah, I try to kind of get as close to like the source as I can. I wouldn't be able to exist without like the Internet Archive, the Wayback Machine, archive.org, if anyone's ever heard. It's like a big resource full of like old websites, magazine scans, and like interviews potentially with like people from actually back in the day. Because obviously like people are still around and still talk about the stuff that they did 20 years ago. But it's then different to compare those accounts from the present with what they were saying in the past, when it was perhaps a bit more like slick and more PR. And just interviews as well. I try to, if I can get in touch with anyone as well from back in the day, and do like my own like sort of primary research, along with all like looking at the magazines, looking at dusty old websites full of like Amiga Action or whatever, or Sinclair User. Then that's what I'll do, and just try and compile like the most like interesting stories I can into a video.
Do you ever find yourself getting lost? Because I'll look back through your Sinclair, trying to research something, and then the next minute I've read the entire magazine, I'm on to the next one, and I'm like lost down a black hole for like days. Yeah. And then I'm like, I've got a video to make today, and then I have to push something out rapidly.
Sometimes, yeah, I mean, it's difficult. I mean, some sites are kind of handy, especially like the magazine sites. World of Spectrum, back when it was still really good, well, I mean, it still kind of has. It had, like, whenever you, like, researched a game, it'd have all the instances that a game that actually appeared in a magazine, whether it was in advert or in print review. That's kind of one of these things. When I did Cassette 50, I don't know if anyone's heard of that, the greatest compilation of all time. I was able to kind of figure out, like, just how many times Cassette 50 was advertised in the Spectrum magazine, because it was all on the on the World of Spectrum page, and I think the number was like 300 or something like that. I mean, never actually reviewed in a magazine because it was so terrible, just the most basic of basic games, but mentioned more than literally any other computer game in the 1980s, I think, in magazines. Nick's man, just silly things like that. And then I can compare, like I don't know, Underworld was mentioned like 100 times, Jetpack 200, and then Cassette 50 like 369 or whatever, compared to like all the classics just so far ahead.
There are some great resources, aren't there? Like World of Spectrum, they are amazing and often don't get enough acknowledgement that they should. Yeah. Archive.org, you're right, is an amazing collection.
Hall of Light as well for Amiga Magazine Rack.
Yeah. So many of my videos just wouldn't exist without.
No,
yeah,
no,
absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Imagine making a video without the internet. Going to the library.
I'll get one out of
you. Compton's
or so.
Encyclopedia or something.
You just make it all up and they'll
talk to people.
Well, Peter, you and I were talking backstage then about the Atari Jaguar. And one thing that always appeals to me on YouTube is finding out about obscure systems that you may not know that much about, or failed consoles. And I know you had a CDI at one point, Stuart. I mean,
I still do have a handheld one, so I can play it on the train.
I didn't know there was a handheld CDI.
Oh, yeah, and it was only sold to shops as like demonstration unit. I don't know, it's the CDI, it's all weird.
I was going to ask, have any of you got any favourite kind of underrated or maybe failed consoles?
As we were talking earlier, it's the Atari Falcon, which is an amazing system and should have done so much better if Atari had had the money to push it. When it went up against the Amiga 1200, it is more powerful than that. And the Amiga, I know you're Amiga fan boys, but the Falcon's an amazing system. And I was lucky enough to get sent one the other week, and you know, I almost exploded with joy. I mean, I was like, whoa, what's in this package? But yeah, it's got to be the Falcon.
I can't wait to see that video.
Yeah, me either. I hope it works.
I think it's a shame the Jaguar never really got anything that actually pushed the hardware, particularly at the time. Because, I mean, like Alien versus Predator was okay, wasn't it?
And that's hard to play.
It's on the floor. It's
really slow hits.
With a D-pad as well.
Even if they managed to get it technically right, the game design was a bit off, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. But, I mean, things like Club Drive coming out versus Ridge Racer. I mean, God. Wasn't Club Drive famously actually laughed at by the journalists when they unveiled it? At a PR do.
Yeah, they mentioned that yesterday.
I was there. Oh my God, we have corroboration. There we are. But yeah, it would have been nice to have seen something that pushed it a bit instead of, you know, Kasumi Ninja and Ultra Vortec and Billy the Potato Man, which I made up, but it's probably better than any of the games they actually released.
Yeah, I like the Jaguar. I suppose I'm a bit more like in that modern era as well. I love the 32X and the Mega CD. Even though the majority of the games on that Mega CD are awful, like FMV games, I'm weirdly really into them. I just love owning Crisscross Make My Video and stuff.
Yeah, that's not what you said in my book. That is not what you said.
It's cool to own now, but I mean, it's something on a shelf. Oh, look, there it is. It gives me a chuckle, but yeah, it's or In Excess Make My Video. They did that.
CNC
as well.
Music Factory.
Yeah. I love that. You know, I still remember seeing Road Avenger and being absolutely blown away. Like, graphics will never look better than this.
Road Avenger is an amazing game.
It is.
It's driving around and blowing up everything as you go. And what's not to love about it?
There needs to be an HD remake of that game.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well,
yeah.
We mentioned some terrible games there as well as some good ones. What is the appeal with terrible games, mainly for Stuart?
It's that kind of thing when, you know, I was driving past a car crash and I couldn't help but stare. Do you know what I mean? It's when something goes completely horribly wrong, there's something interesting to it, especially to the level where you just could not enjoy playing the game. How did this get released? You know, the answer is nobody cared and just put it on a tape, obviously. But there is that kind of bizarre fascination with the dive to the bottom. Because if you ask online, you know, what's the worst game ever, everybody will say, oh, E.T. for the Atari 2600, which is pretty bad. Superman for the N64, blah, blah, blah. But, oh, there's worse if you scratch the surface. There's really worse. People paid money for Squidge.
Squidge, yes. I mean, which, unless you hack into the code, you can't play. You literally can't move it because the person who programmed it, all the code was in uppercase, but he put like the directions in lowercase. So for that reason, you just can't play it at all. You can't move it unless you hack into the game.
It was just an edutainment program way ahead of its time. Programming for kids.
Figure it out.
And it's so badly designed that when you do hack in and turn off caps lock or whatever, I still couldn't figure out that anything worked. It was actually Kim who discovered that you could shoot enemies. It just gives you zero visual feedback.
Yeah, there's no feedback.
And no audio feedback. So how are you supposed to know that works? Just wait for a letter through the post from the programmer?
It's a life lesson. Mm.
Well, Stuart, has NAF stuff always appealed to you? Because I know a lot of your videos are about, like, you know, Poundland pickups and that kind of thing.
Oh, yes. I don't know why. Do you know, my favourite games, I was thinking recently, there's always something slightly shonky about them, for instance. I don't know why that is. But it's something about imperfection, which, I don't know, endears me to an extent. But when something's really, really bad, that's when it sort of ticks that thing in your mind that just says, how has this happened? Why has this happened? Why am I alive? Or maybe that's just me. I don't know.
I think the thing is with... I usually do games that I like, but sometimes terrible games, especially when there's something just interesting about them as well. Like, there's one game that I covered quite recently called Super Trolley, which is this budget Spectrum game. And it has kind of a checkered past because it was actually... a kid designed it and got Jimmy Savile on Jim Will Fix It. Yeah.
Boy.
Squick. To design and make for Mastertronic. And it is basically, it's a game where you are a shelf stacker in a supermarket. And it's even less interesting than that sounds. It's almost like, I mean, and I kind of played it and thinking like, games are supposed to be fun. They're supposed to, you know, take you into some fantasy world. this is mundanity in the extreme.
Who thought that was a good idea?
Jimmy Savile.
Well, Daniel, you kind of cover a lot of failed Kickstarters as well. Are there any particular ones that have stuck out in your mind?
Okay. So a few weeks ago, I did six times. I called it a really nasty title as well. Like me and my wife, she helped me make it because it was so much stuff that we had to research on it. So it's the Kickstarter scum that ran away with your money six times, I called it. And I call him names all the way through and all this other stuff. And I wonder if he'll ever see it. And 5 hours after it went live, he became a Patreon of mine. And I was like, I wonder if it's... No, that's not him. And then it was a little bit nervous because all my Patreons were in a big Discord chat just completely dissing him. Like, oh, what an absolute... You know, all this sort of stuff. And I probably should get rid of him because he's going to start attacking my Patreons now. So I blocked him and I gave him his refund also because I don't really want him paying me if he's not giving any Kickstarters their rewards. And then he... no one knows this, actually. Yet. I might be talking about this in a future video, but he sent a DMCA to Patreon to get my Patreon taken down. Not the video, but the Patreon taken down. So I got very nervous and I started asking the Patreon to hang on. Is he trying to take down my Patreon or is he trying to take down the video? And he's like, oh, just the video. I'm like, well, he can't do that. That's on YouTube. And they went, oh, okay. Well, I think all he wants to do then is take down the post. I mean, so he's going to all this effort for me to take down a post that says go and check out a video. I mean, my Patrons know who I am. They'll just go and look at the video if they want to go look at it. So I had to remove it. I think it's not the last I've heard from him. I'm pretty sure it's not the last I've heard from him. He hates me. There's
and surprise, surprise, he's here today.
So, and a couple of weeks before that, I did the Kickstarter project that got destroyed by the Sun. And I don't mean the Sun newspaper. The way it worked was there was a girl making a board game about the solar system, and it was going fine, little couple of hiccups, but the board game community helped her out. Everything was nice and humble, and then one day she updated the update section on Kickstarter and said, I've the Sun's been talking to me. The Sun has been talking to me, and they're scared that I'm giving away too many secrets. And they had to try and stop making it. And it was so bizarre. And I made a video about this because I found that so interesting. And then I actually interviewed her at the end, and she's insanely, I want to say racist, but I don't think she actually is racist. I got called really nasty names. And then after it went live, she became a friend of mine, and she's sending me a copy of the game for review. And I've obviously paid her for it because no way can I get a copy and the backers haven't. Yeah, I'm doing lots of these. I'm going to do an update video on all these crazy things that keep happening because there's loads more stories as well. It's pretty crazy.
On only your channel, you cover Sega a lot, and there is obviously a lot of love for Sega here on the panel.
Yes.
You guys ever think that Sega can come back, or is it too late? Can they come back in maybe hardware?
They've pushed out too much tripe in the years since, haven't they? I mean, Nintendo have played the game and they've pushed out quality products, but yeah. Sega just went down quantity over quality, and I just don't think they've got the drive to do that.
Growing up as a Sega fanboy, like all my mates were Nintendo fanboys, and when we got a GameCube and I put in Sonic Heroes and I saw the Sega logo come up, and then the Nintendo logo come up, I was just, oh. It was like a proper punch in the gut, and all my friends are like, ooh, I bet that hurt. they could totally come back. I mean, I think they may be on the right path with Sonic Mania. They just need to get a hold of their classic franchises that people do want to see and make a proper brand new Streets of Rage, which I suppose technically happened with Streets of Rage Remake before they got it taken down. They just need to hit heavy with the indie scene, I think, and they would do really well, but I don't think they will, sadly.
No, I don't think they will. Things like Sonic Mania are a good thing, but, I mean, that's down to, like, the fans. I mean, the guy made, like, Christian Whitehead's been a fan of Sonic and a great programmer, and it kind of came from the fan scene as opposed to internally from Sega. I think the trouble is I'm not even sure, really, just how many of those guys are there anymore. Like, the guys who made, like, the Mega Drive and, like, the classic, like, System 16 teams and all that. How many of them were even there?
Well, that's
I thought
the
it was
thing.
All, like, American Sammy.
I mean, there's nothing really left of Sega in that sense, certainly not hardware.
Sammy are doing bad as well at the moment. They're hitting big hits at the moment.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, talking of former greats as well, you're really into the Acorn and BBC computers, Peter, and you cover them a lot on your channel. Can you tell us about your kind of school experiences with them?
I do. I mean, I need to cover them more recently. But yeah, the BBC Micro was the machine I had at school. I remember it being wheeled in on a red trolley. I was like, what is this? Unveiled like with a cloak. It's like people crowding around it. Like, look at the wonder. And just as I was talking about earlier with the turtle and the logo programming language, seeing that turtle draw a massive picture in the sports hall was crazy. And then the school got a Doomsday machine with the massive laser discs. And then I found myself wandering around, I can't remember what town it was, but Leicester or somewhere, which is a bit random, but. Maybe, yeah, something like that. But so in the middle of school, I was like walking around Ashby. I was like, this is interesting. And it kind of, it was like an early first person perspective game. A bit like an early Google Maps, really. Way ahead of its time. So I think Acorn and BBC got so much right and they were so far ahead of their time.
I guess, you know, today, the ARM processor's in every mobile phone, and that came out of the Acorn Arcade.
It did, absolutely.
Sophie Wilson.
Sophie Wilson, yeah. And Steve Ferber, they did so much to get to that position. It's a shame that they got caught up in the 1984 sort of crash, and Olivetti had to buy them out. Otherwise, they could have possibly gone in a different direction. We could have had BBCs everywhere instead of the IBM's. Doubtful, but you know, it's
very doubtful.
A BBC phone.
Yeah.
Well, this is a question to all of you, really. How big is your console and computer collection then? Is it kind of, do you have a storage area for it, or is it kind of spilling out of every room in your house?
It's absolutely huge. I've seen Peter's office, and I can confirm he has everything that's ever existed, often two of them.
Yeah, it's a bit greedy, really. I should probably disperse that a little. But yeah, it's just nice to be surrounded by all these iconic machines. It's like a quest. Like, all these machines I wanted when I was younger, I can now get. And I just sit in a circle around them and talk to them. It's lovely.
I think that is a big part of the appeal, though, isn't it? The fact that, you know, you look at these dream machines that were thousands of pounds when you were a kid, and they seem so far out of reach. Mm. And if you can get one off eBay for, like, 300 quid today.
Even though they've got a fraction of the power of your desktop, you're like, this is so much nicer than my PC. It can do so much more. You still think that in your mind. Well, I do, at least.
It's the aesthetic, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the aesthetic, yeah. Mm.
What's your collection like, Kim? Have you got lots?
My collection's actually probably significantly smaller than everyone else's. I don't really have anything specific that I collect just because I don't really have space or anything like that. I kind of got rid of all my stuff like a few years ago in a fit of pique. But I'm slowly building it back up, trying to get all the stuff that I had from my childhood back. And so it's always nice to kind of find something good for a decent price.
You guys have any kind of consoles or machines on your hit list that you really want to get and you haven't been able to get your hands on?
I've got the Falcon and the Mega PC, which were my two main machines I lusted after. So, you know, I'm just living the life, really, now.
I want to start collecting for the PC Engine. I want to get myself a Jaguar as well, which I know they're not that hard to get. You know, they're not, like, completely out of reach. But, I haven't actually got the biggest gaming collection. I've got a moderate size. It's pretty good. But I sold my entire Mega Drive collection because I thought it would be a really good idea when the Dreamcast came out if I sold every single game I own for a pound a pop to buy a third and fourth Dreamcast controller, which I never used, which was so painful. And then when I walk around out in the Traders Hall and I'm seeing Streets of Rage 3, 120 quid, I had that. Oh, I had the Punisher. Oh. Yeah. Oh. And but, you know, someone got it for a pound. And I actually bumped into that guy where I sold them all to at a boot fair selling some PlayStation 2 games. And I just looked at him like, you were the guy.
Was he wearing like a golden suit?
Massive
gold grill, everything.
Come and see DJ Sloop's collection.
Charging for entry.
And then I lost the Dreamcast controllers in a move and bought them again for £2.50 recently. So talk about. But no, I mean, I'm trying to collect again, but I'm trying to collect quirky things. And annoyingly, until I get take this, you know, YouTube thing full time, which I'm not doing yet, I will have, you know, how Pete's got with his room. I'd love a game room to be able to put it all in, because when I do a complete history and I go out and buy, have I got Echo the Dolphin? I'll go buy Echo the Dolphin online. It won't much, like 10, 20 quid. And then I go upstairs, I've got it 3 times now. You know, so I need at the moment they're just in boxes, sadly.
Most of my collection is very old computers from sort of early 80s. Because when researching the Terrible Old Games books, I realised at some point somebody was going to say, well, I wrote that game and actually it works fine in the original hardware. It's you emulating it. No. Oh, no, my friend. Allow me to point you towards my TI-99-4A, running your game on the original hardware through a CRT, and I think you'll find those graphics do flicker, darling. It hasn't happened yet, but I'm looking forward to being really smarmy when it does. Collection-wise, I'm still trying to complete my Sega Saturn game collection, which I will never get anywhere near, because once you've got half of them, the other half are all like £30-40 each. So I might complete it if I live to be 10,000 years old.
Have you got the super rare ones with the Sega Saturn?
A few of them. I've got Panzer Dragoon Saga, yeah. Which my agent just gave me one day. He went, I'll go and found this. I'm like, what the frick? What? Do you know what this is worth? Yes. Well, I'm just having it anyway. But he also gave me a Jaguar, so, you know, the world balances out, doesn't it? I've got Street Fighter Collection, which I didn't think was that rare, but I saw it in the trader hall for like £150.
That surprised me. I had that as well. Yeah. I got that.
What I'd really like is Deep Fear.
The last
one. Not the game, just in general. I think it would be a really good state of mind. No, it's like, as Kim was about to say, the very last released Saturn game, yep, in the UK, and it's like a really bad Resident Evil.
Yeah, so Resi clone only in a submarine, isn't it? Or like an underwater space station,
Killing two birds with one stone in that narrative. Yes.
Sea station.
Yeah. I would like that. I think just because it's the last one, also it's very rare and expensive. But I'm trying to think what the most expensive game is. Mr. Bones, maybe?
Yeah, that probably. One. Yeah, Panzer Dragoon.
Yeah. Maybe. I think Panzer Dragoon is not as rare as you think in that sense, or as pricey as you think. But the problem is it came in like a cardboard box that's easily damaged by, you know, photons and background radiation. So very few of them are sort of complete and decent.
We did mention about writing books there. You've got 2 books out now.
Yes.
What was kind of the process?
Have you all bought it yet?
A few in the audience. Hey.
Thank you. I was scared that wouldn't work for a second.
But did you ever imagine that you'd be a published author? And what was kind of the process of writing those books then?
Oh, God. When I was young, I used to write a lot of stories and fiction. So I thought maybe I could do a fiction book one day. But then I realised it was a lot more fun to just play crap old games and laugh at them.
And you did write terrible old games as well.
Yes. Yeah, that was a weird research thing, because I started doing it for a video series, and then it sort of expanded into this book, and I was surprised at the end of it by just how many there were when you really look into it, because I thought, could I get enough to fill a book? Now I could fill probably 5 books. I could do a book alone on the Amstrad CPC and the awful ports it got, you know. It was a much bigger field than I thought, much bigger.
Well, we're going to give you guys a chance to ask some questions now, but please just give a round of applause to our audience. Thank you very much. Okay, so any questions? Just raise your hand if you've got one. Ravi will run over with the mic.
This is a question to the panel. We live in an era of hardware reboots, and there's a hell of a lot of Spectrum, ZX Spectrum ones. I'm just wondering if there's any retro computer or console that you would like to see rebooted.
I'd like to see an N64, just because it's the Nintendo console that doesn't emulate that well, and it's really hard to connect them decently to a modern television. So hopefully they'll get onto that now that they've made 11 bajillion pounds on the SNES Mini.
The same for the Sega Saturn. That's where Sega could come back, because if Sega made a Sega Saturn, basically that would actually play games and then chuck, you know, maybe 10 or 20 games in there, chuck your typical Sonic R, all that sort of stuff, but it actually could play games as well, get an HDMI thing on the back, that would outsell anything that, you know, everyone would want one of those. This is what they could do to come back, but they won't. But
you'll
yeah,
get
Sega Saturn
games
for me.
On it. It'll be a cardboard box with Saturn written on it.
I think I'd like to see the Sam Coupe brought back, mainly because it's so bloody expensive. So to get like a cheaper version would be nice, I think.
Do you know, actually, going back to the which console would you like, that is one thing I would like, a Sam Coupe. Have you got one in your office that I can touch?
No, I'd prefer not to talk about that, please.
I apologise.
I was thinking it would be good to see like an Amiga joystick that you plugged into the TV with all the games on, like they did that Commodore 64 thing a couple of years ago.
That'd be brilliant. Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking. Like a sort of Amiga that's, yeah, just got a whole bunch of gamers, or you can put an SD card in, put them all easy. I mean, you can do a lot of that with like a RetroPie if you've got like the technical know-how, but it'd be nice to see like a proper Amiga one. I think there was one a couple of years ago called the Amiga.
There is, yes. Yeah, I've been using it to image discs, which is a great way to get loads of dirt in a disc drive, because old discs, bloody hell. Yeah. Mm.
Any more questions?
Yeah, one here.
Kim, do you think you'll ever do another Kim Blitz?
Will I do another Kim Blitz? I might do something where I'd end up doing that, because I mean, for anyone who didn't know, like the Kim Blitz was something that I did like every day, like had a review like in a month. I think it was like February 2 years ago. I did like a review every day for like 28 days. It was mental. I really shouldn't have done it. I might do something, not necessarily like the Kim Blitz, but like licensed games sort of videos that I did, because that's kind of one of my soft spots. I really like covering like old licensed games that no one remembers, that no one liked at the time, but there's always something quite interesting about that to me. So I might resurrect that in the future.
This is for the panel. What would you say the strangest story behind a retro game that you've come across is?
I mean, Squidge takes some beating, doesn't it?
It really does.
I mean, basically written by somebody under contract who had to deliver something, so he deliberately wrote something in a couple of days that he knew was so bad they wouldn't release it. They didn't even look at it. They just duplicated it and sent it out to the shops.
Yeah.
Hence
quality
why
control.
It doesn't work. Yeah.
I quite like Squeak. I'm not sure what home computer that was, but basically they accidentally sent the not finished version out. It was finished, but what basically the developer did was every time you completed a level, instead of saying hooray or some quirky little thing, he would say, F your mother. and that got into like all the new usual papers, but I mean, we couldn't find anything. And when I done my Squeak complete history, I said to him, so did this happen? Yes, it did. So it went out and they accidentally sent the wrong tape instead of sending the proper one, where they changed it back. They don't send their jokey little one that they made themselves, where every time you complete a level, Squeak tells you to F your mother.
God.
I think it's Lotus Turbo Challenge, where if you isolate some of the audio tracks, you get some abusive lyrics thrown at you through the computer, which is quite, I quite like finding things like that stuffed into games where the program was clearly disgruntled. He's like, screw you, let's just put this in here. And he's satisfied with that. It's quite nice.
One of my favourite ones is the Bitmap Brothers. Mike Montgomery tells this story about how back in the early days they were commissioned by Mastertronic, or they were going to be commissioned by Mastertronic, to make a game about real tennis. It's like, you know, I don't know if it's like the one with the roof and that. It's like kind of squashy. And they researched it for like a month, like researched real tennis just to make this the best real tennis game ever. I don't think there's ever actually been a real tennis video game. And so they go to Mastertronic and they come, and the first thing that they say in the meeting is, we've decided not to make a real tennis game. So all this like books of research that you've done, you can just throw those in the bin. And so kind of described, and then literally they went to the pub and on the back of a fag packet, they designed Speedball, or the idea for Speedball. Like it's weird, like Speedball, like this crazy futuristic future sports game, comes out like one of the oldest sports like played by the gentry, basically. That's a really strange kind of how these things work sometimes. And then they made no money from it because it was made by Mirrorsoft, and then Robert Maxwell fell off a yacht.
Why has our company gone? Man fell off a yacht. Oh, makes sense, yeah. Actually, my favourite story of that is the Pickford Brothers Zub, which is an old, very good budget game. £3, little man jumps about, amusing character, nice physics, etc., blah, blah, blah. It was originally called Zob, right up until the point of being sent to the duplicator, who pointed out that's a swear word in French. And if you look, they had the artist, Steve Pickford, had to change it absolutely at the last minute and get couriers to send new tapes. And if you actually look at the game's loading screen, the title screens, you can see where it clearly said Zob, and they've just had to use character blocks to take the top out of the O to make it a U. So look out for that the next time you happen to be playing a game called Zub.
We have got time for a couple more questions.
This is for the panel. What do you think about the game Simpsons Hit and Run?
I think it's a great game.
So it's like the first good Simpsons game, if I remember. Yeah, unless really you count the arcade game, I suppose. But
yeah, the arcade game.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with that. That was a cool game.
Yeah, but was it the Grand Theft Auto?
Yeah.
I think it was the first one made for sort of home consoles that wasn't like a very pared-down game for children, wasn't it? Because things like Simpsons Wrestling was basically press a button to wrestle.
Oh, yeah. Or there was like Bart versus the Space Mutants.
Oh, my God. What a mess
that was.
What
was the Dreamland one where... You know what I'm about? He has to keep going. He has to do his homework while he's asleep.
Yeah, Bart's Nightmare. Virtual Bart.
Virtual Bart. That's a really rare game, that, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, there was the Simpsons Crash Crazy Taxi ripoff where there was a whole lawsuit as well.
Yeah, Road Rage.
Road Rage? Yeah, that was good.
Oh, and there was a Krusty's Funhouse one. I'd forgotten all of these existed, yeah.
So the Simpsons on the Xbox 360 is quite an alright game. It's like
not
playable.
That one.
It's not great, it's pretty good.
There's a movie film as well. A movie film? Yeah, one of those new movie films they're inventing. A game based on the movie.
That's the one, yeah.
Also, Bart's House of Weirdness, which is another terrible old game that no one's ever heard of.
I have genuinely not heard of that. Which system? Do my research for me now.
PC, like 1991. It's
awful. Oh, I don't
cover
PC.
It's so awful. You don't have a PC.
I don't cover PC.
Because
then it came out too late.
Too American.
Hello. Barring the other guests on the panel, are there any YouTubers you'd like to work with?
I'd like to work with Logan Paul so I could arrange an accident.
I'd like to work with PewDiePie just for the money.
I've chatted to Norm Gaming Historian, so I imagine he will appear in one video eventually soon. But other than obviously Larry and a few other people, obviously I reckon I discovered you guys after, not you, Ashton's, but I discovered you guys after I started a YouTube channel. Yeah, Norm, that would be really good. But Lazy Game Reviews is one of my biggest influences when starting my channel, so I'd love to one day work with him. And we've chatted so many times, and I'm such a last-minute person. Can you send me this audio? But I need it in 3 hours' time. And, yeah, he needs a lot more time than that. It'll come.
Serious answer. I mean, there's lots of people kind of big and small. I'm an avid YouTube watcher. I've got so many different things. There's quite a few people in this room, like, who are also doing great stuff. People like Retro Man Cave, some were here, Back Office, right in front of me, Maddie, Miss Madlemon, all do like brilliant stuff. And I'm the sort of person that if anyone like comes to me like with an idea, I don't care, like, it's like, oh, have you got like 10,000 subs or whatever? If not, I don't care. Like, if you've got a brilliant idea, then yeah, I'm up for anything, really.
It's a great way of promoting good channels. It's so hard to break that initial barrier. Mm. And just getting a voice in, that sort of thing, is a really cool way to break up your own episode and work with people that, you know, you respect and stuff. I think it's awesome.
Yeah, and plus, I mean, we all started with, like, in the end, none of us started with, like, you know, we got, like, a 10,000, 1,000 subscriber head start. Everyone kind of starts from the same place, really. So it's always good, like, if you've got a big following, I feel, or, like, medium, decent-sized following anyway, to kind of give back and, you know, help people out and just do good stuff together. Like, just, it's kind of more friendly that way instead of, you know, bitchy and nasty.
I think I'd like to work with Retro Man Cave because he seems to have a psychic ability to to do the videos I want to do a week before. Yeah, that Minitel. I found a Minitel on eBay. I thought, this is amazing. It's brand new in box. I'm going to buy that. Went to click buy. Gone. Next day on Twitter, look what I've got, it's a Minitel computer.
You bastard.
You'll have the first Falcon video though, I think, the first full length.
I don't know. I'm watching you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been wonderful getting your stories and hearing your memories. And our panel will be around in the Trader Hall if you'd like to say hello. But for now, please say thank you very much to our panel.
Luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.